This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Crispin, the Cross of Lead by Avi, narrated by Ron Keith.
England, AD 1377. In the midst of life comes death. How often did our village priest preach those words? Yet I've also heard that in the midst of death comes life. If this be a riddle, so was my life. Chapter 1. The day after my mother died, the priest and I wrapped her body in a grey shroud and carried her to the village church. Our burden was not great. In life she had been a small woman with little strength. Death made her even less. Her name had been Aster. Since our cottage was at the village fringe, the priest and I bore her remains along the narrow, rutted road that led to the cemetery. A steady, hissing rain had turned the ground to clinging mud. No birds sang, no bells tolled. The sun hid behind the dark and lowering clouds. We passed village fields where people were at work in the rain and mud. No one knelt. They simply stared. As they had shunned my mother in life, so they shunned her now. As for me, I felt, as I often did, ashamed. It was as if I contained an unnamed sin that made me less than nothing in their eyes. Other than the priest, my mother had no friends. She was often taunted by the villagers. Still, I had thought of her as a woman of beauty, as perhaps all children think upon their mothers. The burial took place among the other paupers' graves in the walled cemetery behind our church. It was there the priest and I dug her grave in water-laden clay. There was no coffin. We laid her down with her feet toward the east, so when the day of judgment came, she would, may God grant it, rise up to face Jerusalem. As the priest chanted the Latin prayers, whose meaning I barely understood, I knelt by his side and knew that God had taken away the one person I could claim as my own. But his will be done. No sooner did we cover my mother's remains with heavy earth than John Aycliffe, the steward of the manor, appeared outside the cemetery walls. Though I'd not seen him, he must have been watching us from astride his horse. "Aster's son, come here," he said to me. Head bowed, I drew close. "Look at me," he commanded, reaching down and forcing my head up with a sharp slap of his gloved hand beneath my chin. It was always hard for me to look on others. To look on John Aycliffe was hardest of all. His black bearded face, hard, sharp eyes and frowning lips, forever scowled at me. When he deigned to look in my direction, he offered nothing but contempt. For me to pass near was to invite his scorn, his kicks, and sometimes his blows. No one ever accused John Aycliffe of any kindness. In the absence of Lord Furnival, he was in charge of the manor, the laws, and the peasants. To be caught in some small transgression, missing a day of work, speaking harshly of his rule, failing to attend mass, brought an unforgiving penalty. It could be a whipping, a clipping of the ear, imprisonment, or a cut-off hand. For poaching a stag, John the Alemaker's son was put to death on the commons gallows. As judge, jury, and willing executioner, Aycliffe had but to give the word, and the offender's life was forfeit. We all lived in fear of him. Aycliffe stared at me for a long while, as if in search of something. All he said, however, was, With your mother gone, you're required to deliver your ox to the manor house tomorrow. It will serve as the death tax.
But, sir,
I said, for my speech was slow and ill-formed, if I do, I won't be able to work the fields. Then starve, he said, and rode away without a backward glance. Father Quinnell whispered into my ear, come to church, Astor's son. We'll pray. Too upset, I only shook my head. God will protect you, he said, resting his hand on my shoulder, as he now protects your mother. His words only distressed me more. Was death my only hope? Seeking to escape my heart's cage of sorrow, I rushed off toward the forest, barely aware of the earth beneath my feet or the roof of trees above. I paid no mind into what I ran, or that my sole garment, a grey wool tunic, tore on brambles and bushes. Nor did I care that my leather shoes, catching roots or stones, kept tripping me, causing me to fall. Each time I picked myself up and rushed on, panting, crying. Deeper and deeper into the ancient woods I went, past thick bracken and stately oaks, until I tripped and fell again. This time, as God in his wisdom would have it, my head struck stone. Stunned, I lay upon the decaying earth, fingers clutching rotting leaves, a cold rain drenching me. As daylight faded, I was entombed in a world darker than any night could bring. Chapter 2. Long past the hour of Compline, the last prayers of the night, a sound aroused me to a confused state of wakefulness. Because of the utter darkness and the painful throbbing in my head, I knew not where I was. Though unable to see, I could smell the air and realized I wasn't at my home, nor was I in the fields where I often slept with the ox. Only when I sniffed again did I become sure of the woodland smells and cloying air. The rain had ceased, but it was as if night itself had begun to sweat. Then, in a burst, I recalled my mother's death and burial, my leaving the cemetery and the priest, my plunge into the woods. I remembered tripping, falling. Putting a hand to my forehead, I felt a welt and a crust of hardened blood. Though my touch made me wince, the pain banished the remaining dizziness. I realized I was in the forest and lost. My tunic was cold and wet. Lifting my head, I looked about. Midst the tangle of trees, I saw a flickering light. Puzzled, I came up on my knees to see better. But save that flame, all was murk and midnight mist, and silence lay as thick as death. In haste, I made the sign of the cross and murmured protective prayers. Mind, godly folk had no business beyond their lawful homes at such a time. Night was a mask for outlaws, hungry wolves, the devil and his minions. Then who or what, I asked myself, had caused the sound that had brought me to my senses? It was my curiosity, another name my mother had often said for Satan, that made me want to see what was there. Despite fear of discovery, I crept through the woods. When I came as near to the light as I dared, I raised my head and tensed my legs, ready to flee if necessary. Two men were standing in a clearing. One was John Aycliffe. In one hand he held a fluttering torch. As always, a sword was at his side. The second man I'd never seen before. Dressed like a gentleman with a face of older years, he wore a hood attached to a flowing cape that hung down behind his legs. Grey hair reached his shoulders. His blue over-tunic was long, quilted and dark, with yellow clasps that gleamed in the torchlight. Within the circle of light, I also saw the fine head of a horse. I assumed it was the stranger's. The two men were talking. Straining to listen, forgetful of the danger, I rose up from the bushes where I hid. As I looked on, the stranger pushed aside his cape and brought forth a wallet. From it he drew a parchment packet, affixed with red wax seals. He handed it to Aycliffe. The steward unfolded it. The parchment was wide and filled with what looked like writing. Three more red seals and ribbons dangled from the bottom edge. Passing the stranger the torch, so he could see better, Aycliffe took up the document and cast his eyes over it. "By the bowels of Christ!" I heard him exclaim, even as he made the sign of the cross over his chest. "When will it happen?" "If God wills, it will come soon," the stranger said. "And am I to act immediately?" Aycliffe asked the man. "Are you not her kin?" the stranger said. "Do you not see the consequences if you don't?" "A great danger to us all."
"Precisely. There could be those who will see it so and act accordingly. You'll be placed in danger too."
As a frowning Aycliffe began to fold the document, he turned away. When he shifted, he saw me. Our eyes met. My heart all but stopped.
"Astor's son!"
Aycliffe cried. The stranger whirled about.
"There!"
the steward shouted, pointing right at me. Throwing the document aside, he snatched back the torch, drew his sword, and began to run in my direction. Transfixed by fear, I stood rooted to the spot. Not until he came close to me did I turn and flee, but no sooner did I than I became ensnared in brambles that caught me in their thorny grasp. Though I struggled and pulled, it was to no avail. I was too well caught. All the while Aycliffe was drawing closer, his face filled with hate. When he drew near, he lifted his sword and swung it down. In his haste, the sword's descending arc missed me, but cut the brambles so that I could rip myself away before he could take another stroke. I ran on. Aycliffe continued to pursue me, sword and torch up. He would have caught me if I had not, in my blind panic, tumbled over a cliff. Though of no great height, it took me by such surprise I went hurtling through the air, crashing hard upon my side and rolling farther down a hill. I was stunned, my breath gone, but I had enough sense to roll over and look back. Above me, at some distance, I saw Aycliffe's torch and his face peering down. When I realized he had no idea where I was, I dared not move. When his light finally retreated, did I pick myself up and flee. I ran as far as strength and breath allowed, halting only when my legs gave out. Then I threw myself upon the ground, gasping for breath. For the remainder of the night, I found little rest. Not only was I in fear of being found and made subject to the steward's wrath, I was still engulfed by grief at my mother's death. Then, too, I'd turned from the priest when he had asked me to church. I had broken the curfew, too. Why, I'd even stolen church wine to ease my mother's pains before she died. In short, I was certain God was punishing me. Even as I waited for his next blow, I sought, with earnest prayers, forgiveness for my sinful life. Chapter 3. That life of mine began on the Feast of St. Giles in the year of our Lord, 1363, the 36th year of the reign of Edward III, England's great warrior king. We resided in Stromford village with its 150 souls. For as long as I could recall, my mother had simply called me Son, and since her name was Astor, Astor's son, became my common name. In a world in which one lived by the light of a father's name and rank, that meant, since I had no father, I existed in a shadow. But he, like so many, had died before my birth during a recurrence of the great mortality, often called the plague, or so my mother had informed me. She rarely mentioned him. Nor did she ever take another husband, a circumstance I didn't question. It would have been a rare man who would want so frail and impoverished a woman for a wife. For in the entire kingdom of England there could have been no poorer Christian souls than my mother and I. I had few friends, and none I completely trusted. As Astor's son, I was oft the butt of jests, jibes, and relentless hounding. "Why do they taunt me so?" I once asked Father Quinnell during one of my confessions. These confessions were numerous, since I had become convinced there was some sin embedded in me, a sin I was desperate to root out.
"Be accepting," was the priest's advice. "Think how our blessed Christ was taunted on his cross."
I did try to accept my life, but unlike our perfect Jesus, I was filled with caution and suspicion, always expecting to be set upon or mocked. In short, I lived the life of the shunned, forever cast aside, yet looking on, curious as to how others lived. There was little my mother or I could do about our plight. We were not slaves, but neither were we free. The steward, John Aycliffe, never lost an opportunity to remind us of the fact that we were villains, serfs, bound to Furnival, Lord of Stromford Village. Yet this Lord Furnival had fought in France, or had been off to mercenary wars, for so many years that most villagers, including myself, had never set eyes on him. It didn't matter. Spring, summer, and fall, save certain holy days, my mother and I, like every other Stromford villager, worked his fields from dawn to dusk. When winter came, we fed the animals. We had an ox, and now and then a chicken. Gathered wood and brush for heat. Slept, and tried to stay alive. At a time when bread cost a quarter penny a loaf, the value of my mother's daily labour, by King Edward's royal decree, was a penny each day, mine but a farthing. Our food was barley bread, watered ale, and from time to time some cooked dried peas. If good fortune blessed us, there might be a little meat at Christmastide. Thus our lives never changed, but went round the rolling years beneath the starry vault of distant heaven. Time was the great millstone which ground us to dust like kernelled wheat. The Holy Church told us where we were, in the alterations of the day, the year, and in our daily toil. Birth and death alone gave distinction to our lives, as we made the journey between the darkness from whence we had come to the darkness where we were fated to await Judgment Day. Then God's terrible gaze would fall on us and lift us to heaven's bliss, or throw us down to the everlasting flames of hell. This was the life we led. It was, no doubt, the life my forefathers had led, as had all men and women since the days of Adam. With all my heart, I believed that we would continue to live the same until Archangel Gabriel announced the end of time. And with my mother's death, it was as if that time had come. Chapter 4. Following my escape from John Aycliffe and my night of forest hiding, it was the sound of a tolling bell that woke me. Dawn had come, and the Stromford Church was announcing early morning prayers, prime. In haste, I made the sign of the cross over my heart, offered up my daily prayer and listened closely. All I heard was the sound of the bell and muted forest babble, nothing to alarm me. Once awake, however, I could only think of what I'd seen the night before, the meeting in the woods of the steward and the stranger. Nor could I remove from my mind the steward's hateful look when he brought down his sword with the clear intent of killing me. Even so, I tried to convince myself that it wouldn't matter. In the past, Aycliffe had treated me badly. His attack on me the night before was not that great an exception. Why should he, I told myself, be concerned that I, a nobody, had seen him at his forest meeting? It seemed my best course of action would be to return to my home and act as though nothing untoward had occurred. With the coming of morning's light, it took little to determine where I was. I made my way toward the village. Since my mother had been a cotter, one who held no land in her own right, she and I lived in a rented one-room dwelling that stood at the far edge of our village by the northern boundary cross. A thin thatch roof kept out most rain. Earth was our floor. And since it was at some distance from the village, I was able to remain hidden from those who had already gone to their daily labour. I was just about to emerge from the woods and run toward our hut when I caught sight of the bailiff, Roger Kinsworthy, and the reeve, Odo Langland. Not only were they carrying pikes and axes, they were heading for my cottage. Unsettled, I drew back quickly and concealed myself behind some bushes to observe their intentions as they entered our small building. Perhaps they were looking for me because they emerged in moments. But then, to my great shock, they began to use their tools to pull the structure down. The cottage, being of small, mean construction, could not withstand their assault. Within moments, it was little more than a heap of thatch, wattle and clay. Not content with that, Kinsworthy produced a flint from his wallet, struck sparks, and set ablaze the place I had called my home for 13 years. Deeply shaken, I fled back to the forest. As I went, I kept asking myself why they should have done such a thing. I couldn't believe it was merely because I'd seen the steward in the forest the night before. Once within the woods, I decided to go to a high rock which stood near the forest edge and overlooked our village. Though the rock was difficult to climb, I'd done so before on one of my solitary rambles. It was to be hoped that I'd see something to help me understand what was happening. It was not, however, till mid-morning, which I knew by the position of the sun and the ringing of the church bell proclaiming terse, that I reached the rock. Once having made sure I was alone, I climbed. While the rock was not an easy ascent, at some places it was little less than a cliff, I reached the pinnacle. Once there, I took the further precaution of lying down. Only then did I lift my head and look about. Before me, like some rolled-out tapestry, was my entire world, beneath a sky as blue as Our Lady's blessed robes, a contrast to the greening spring that lay abundant everywhere. Overhead, swallows flitted, free as birds ever are. To the west meandered the river Strom, glittering like a silver ribbon in the golden sun. At this point, the river ran at a shallow depth. Like most, I couldn't swim, but for much of the year, one could wade across. Above and below this ford, depending on the season, the water ran quite deep. A few paces from the river's bank, on the village side, stood one of the stone crosses that marked Stromford's western limit. Covered by mystic markings, this cross had been erected where St. Giles had once appeared. There, on the river's low, tree-lined banks, stood our noble's house, Lord Furnival's Manor, the grandest house I knew. It was where the steward had lived for many years, in the absence of the knight. With stone walls, two levels high, and small windows, the manor was to me like a castle, high, mighty, and impenetrable. Inside, I'd never been allowed to enter, but I'd been told, was an arched hall with a long trestle table and benches, several sleeping rooms, and a chapel. On the walls hung pictures of saints along with ancient battle shields. The lower level was a large storage place meant for the wheat and other foods the village produced. Opposite the manor house, across a road, was the mill. Smaller than Lord Furnival's dwelling, it was built of stout timbers with grinding wheels of massive stone. These wheels were turned by river water, delivered by a run. Not only did the mill grind our wheat and barley, at a cost, it contained the ovens where we villagers, by the steward's decree, baked our bread, which required yet another fee. A road led from the river bank. Once a traveller had crossed the river, a road led east and reached another road that ran north and south. Where these roads met, our stone church, St. Giles by the river, stood with its ancient bell. Above and below the church were our dwelling places, some 40 cottages and huts of wattle and daub, thatch and wood, dirt and mud, all in varying shades of brown. North of the village was the commons, where we peasants grazed our own oxen and sheep. Here, too, were the archery butts where men of age were required, by King Edward's decree, to practice every Sunday. It was also the place where the public stocks and gallows stood. The land for growing crops was laid out in long, narrow strips. One of three strips was planted with barley, another wheat. The final third lay fallow for the grazing of the manor's cattle. As for the two roads that passed through Stromford, all I knew was that they led to the rest of England, of which I had no knowledge. And beyond England, I supposed, came the remaining world. Great Christendom, our priests called it. But in all my life I'd never gone past the boundary crosses which marked the limits of our village. Everything, from the woods, the cottages, the manor house, the mill, the roads, the growing lands, the commons, even the church itself, to the tiny crofts behind our cottages used for planting herbs and roots, everything belonged to Lord Furnival, who held it in the king's name. Indeed, the steward said, "We belong to our lord as well." Like all villagers, we were required to ask the steward's permission to be excused from work if ill, to grind our wheat or bake it, to buy or sell, to travel from our parish, to marry, even to baptize our children. In return, we gained two things. When we died, there was a hope of heaven, and Lord Furnival protected us from the Scots, the French, the Danes, and the wicked infidels. But that morning I had little doubt I'd never be protected again. Chapter 5. As I gazed from the high rock, all seemed calm and completely normal. Men, women, and children were in the fields at their lawful labour, ploughing, weeding, sowing, where they would remain till dusk. But as I watched, I saw two horses with riders emerge from the manor house. By the way one of the riders sat, not well, I was sure it was John Aycliffe, the steward. The other man, I supposed, was the one I'd seen with him the night before. The two rode slowly to the church, dismounted, and then went inside. I waited. The church bell began to ring. It was not the slow, rhythmic pealing that announced the canonical hours, but a strident, urgent clamour, a call to important news. In the fields, people stopped their work and looked about. Within moments, they began to walk toward the church. Others emerged from cottages. It didn't take long before the entire village was assembled in front of the church porch. Once all had gathered, the bell ceased to ring. Three men stepped from the church. The first to come was the steward, then the stranger, the last was Father Quinel, whom I recognised because old age had marked him with a stoop. The trio placed themselves before the doors of the church, where the steward briefly addressed the crowd. Then the stranger held forth at greater length. Finally, Father Quinel spoke. Then, followed by the steward and the stranger, as well as all the villagers, he led the way back into church. The church bell now began to toll again, as if a mass were being announced. But for whom or what purpose, I could not guess. I was tempted to go forward, but my apprehension, greatly increased by the destruction of my home, kept me back. Instead, I bowed my head in prayer. O great and giving Jesus, I, who have no name, who am nothing, who does not know what to do, who is all alone in thy world, I, who am full of sin, I implore thy blessed help, or I'm undone. Chapter 6. In time, people emerged from the church. Most went their several ways, some back to the fields, others to their cottages. Others remained in groups, gossiping, or so I supposed. I'd have given much to hear their words. As for the steward and the stranger, they remounted their horses and retreated to the manor house. Some of the village men went along. Once more I had to decide what to do. I thought of going to the village for help, but there was only one person whom I could trust, Father Quinel. Had not my mother trusted him? Had not he, alone in the village, treated me with some kindness? Even as I decided to speak to him, I saw the steward and the bailiff emerge from the manor house, along with men from the village. They were armed with glaives, long poles with sharp blades attached, as well as bows. I even saw a longbow. Just to see them made me know my worst fears had come true. A hue and cry had been raised against me. Clinging to the rock, I watched the search party for as long as I was able. But when they became hidden by forest cover, it was time for me to flee. My visit to the priest would have to wait until the night. Chapter 7. My day was spent in a hiding game. Even though I was hunted in many places, the merciful saints were kind. I was not caught. The searchers did come close. Once, twice, I could have touched their garments as they passed. On one such occasion, I learned enough to confirm my worst suspicions. It fell out this way. Late in the day, I had climbed into a great oak, so thick with leaves it hid me completely. Below, passing, then pausing, were two men. Matthew was a stout, honest fellow, known for his skill with the glaive. Luke was a small, wiry man, considered Stromford's finest archer. Both men lived near the mill. Pausing beneath the tree in which I hid, I heard Matthew say, "I don't think we'll find the boy. He'll have gone leagues by now." Then Matthew, shaking his head, said, "There's a kind of strength in lunacy. I've seen it before, and the steward says it was madness over his mother's death that caused the boy to break into the manor house and steal his money." When I, in my high perch, heard these words, I could hardly believe them. I was being accused of a theft I hadn't done.
"So it said," Luke replied, but not, I thought, with much conviction.
For a moment, neither spoke. Then Matthew, in a low, cautious voice, said, "If you believe it, do you?" I held my breath as Luke took his time to answer. Then he said, "Do I think that Astor's son, a boy of 13, who's as skittish as a new chick, entered the steward's home, broke into the money chest, and ran off into the forest? Ah, Matthew, I'm sure marvellous things happen in this world. I've seen a few of them myself. But no, by the true cross, I don't believe he did such a thing."
"Nor do I," Matthew said with greater strength. "But the steward says it's so." "And that's the end of it," Luke added with a sigh.
Then they spoke bitterly of the things the steward had done, how he'd increased their labours, imposed countless fines, taken many taxes, increased punishments, and, all in all, limited their ancient freedoms by being a tyrant in the name of Lord Furnival. Luke spat upon the ground and said,
"He's no kin of Lord Furnival, only of his wife."
To which Matthew added,
"God grant our Lord long life, so he may visit us soon, and we might put our petitions before him."
Both men crossed themselves. Having spoken, they drifted off. I'd listened to such talk before, but always whispered. People often complained about their lives, taxes, work, and fees. Indeed, there had been so much talk that the steward, who must have heard of it, called a moot and informed one and all that such speech went against the will of God, our king, and our master, Lord Furnival, that henceforward he would treat all such talk as treason, a hanging offence. Knowing these things couldn't be changed, despite the words of men like Matthew and Luke, I cared little for such matters. But in learning that I was being blamed for a crime I hadn't done, my incomprehension as to my plight only grew. The rest of the day I spent hiding, not even daring, despite my hunger, to search for food. Instead, I waited for darkness, past vespers and beyond, choosing not to stir until I heard the church bell ring the last prayers of the night, Compline. Still I held back, for fear of being seen. But once the day was truly over, when the curfew bell had rung and all lay still as stone, I crawled from my hiding place. The night was intensely dark. Low clouds hid the moon and stars. The air was calm, though animals' slops and whiffs of burning wood made it rank. No lights came from the village, but some gleamed in the manor house. Only then did I creep toward the church, alone, uncertain, and very full of fear. Chapter 8. Father Quinnell lived behind our stone church in an attached room without windows. Though I saw no light beneath his door, one of the few doors our village boasted, I knocked softly.
"Who's there?"
"It's me, Father Quinnell, Astor's son."
A slight sound came from within. The door pulled open. The priest's small, pale face peered out. His once white alb, which covered him neck to foot, seemed ghost-like. Frail from his many years, Father Quinnell had served in Stromford his entire life. Now he was small and wizened, with sparse grey, tonsured hair. Some claimed he was the unwanted son of the previous Lord Furnival, who had provided him with the church living when Quinnell was still a boy.
"God be praised! Is that truly you?"
he whispered.
"Yes, Father," I said, adding quickly, "and I didn't steal that money."
He made the sign of the cross.
"Bless Jesus to hear you say it. I didn't think it likely."
clutching me with his trembling, bony hand, he said, "Come quickly. The church will be safest. You're being looked for everywhere. I have some food for you. If anyone comes, claim sanctuary." He led me inside the church. A large building, it took a man standing on another's shoulders to reach the pointed roof. Some said it was as old as the world, built when our blessed Saviour was first born. Not even Goodwife Peregrine, who was the oldest person in our village, knew for sure. The church contained a single open space where we villagers knelt on the rush-strewn floor to face our priest and altar during Mass. Above, in deep shadow, was the carved crucifix, Jesus in his agony. Below him, on the altar, stood the fat tallow candle, whose constant fluttering flame shed some light upon the white walls of painted lime. The font, where our babes were baptized, was off to one side. Two faded images were on the walls. One was of our Blessed Lady, her eyes big with grief, the tiny holy child in her arms. The other revealed St. Giles, protecting the innocent deer from hunters, a constant reminder as to what our faith should be. Since I was born on his day, and as he was the village's patron saint, I held him for the kin I never had. When no one else was there, I would creep into the church to pray to him. I wished to be the deer that he protected. Near the altar, the priest genuflected. I did the same. Then we knelt, facing each other. "Speak low," he said. "There's always Judas lurking. Are you hungry?" "Yes, Father," I murmured. From behind the tattered altar cloth, he produced a loaf of barley bread and gave it to me. "I was hoping you would come," he said. I took the heavy bread and began to devour it. "Where have you been?" he asked. "In the forest." "Did you know they've been searching for you?" My mouth full, I nodded. "Aycliffe claims you stole money from the manor." "Father," I said, "in all my life, I've never even been in there." "I don't doubt you," the priest said, gently putting his hand to my face to keep me calm. "Most people in the village don't believe the accusation either. But why does Aycliffe put your name to the crime?" I told the priest what had happened when I ran from my mother's burial, my fall, my waking to witness the meeting in the clearing, Aycliffe's attempt to kill me.
"He said none of this," the priest said.
"It's true."
"What was the thing the steward read?" the priest asked. "He never mentioned that either."
"I don't know," I said. Then I asked, "Who was the man he met?"
"Sir Richard Dubray," the priest said. "He's brought word that Lord Furnival, God keep him well, has returned from the wars. He's ill and expected to die."
The stranger said Aycliffe must act immediately.
"About what?"
I shrugged. He said, "Are you not her kin? Do you not see the consequences if you don't?" To which Aycliffe replied, "A great danger to us all." Then the man said, "Precisely. There could be those who will see it so and act accordingly. You'll be placed in danger too." "It made no sense to me," I said. The priest pondered the words in silence. "Father," I said, "what will happen if I'm caught?" The priest put his hand on my shoulder.
"The steward," he said, "has declared you a wolf's head."
"A wolf's head?" I gasped, horrified.
"Do you understand what it means?"
"That I'm considered not human," I said, my voice faltering. "That anyone may kill me. Is that why they pulled down our house?
I suppose.
But why?
The priest sat back and gave himself over to thought. In the dim light I studied his face. He seemed distraught, as if the pain of the whole world had settled in his soul.
Father, I ventured, is it something about my mother?
He bowed his head. When he looked up, it was to gaze at me.
Astor's son, unless you flee, you won't live long.
But how can I leave? I said. I'm bound to the land. They'll never give me permission to go.
He sighed, reached forward, and placed the side of one frail hand beside my face.
Astor's son, listen to me with the greatest care. When I baptized you, you were named Crispin.
I was, I cried.
It was done in secret. What's more, your mother begged me not to tell you or anyone. She chose to simply call you son.
But why? I asked.
He took a deep breath and then said,
did she tell you anything about your father?
Once again the priest took me by surprise.
My father? Only that he died before I was born, in the great mortality, I reminded him. But what has that to do with my name, or any of this?
Dearest boy, the priest said wearily, I beg you to find your way to some town or city with its own liberties. If you can stay there for a year and a day, you'll gain your freedom.
Freedom? I said. What has that to do with me?
You could live by your own choices, as a high-born lord or a king.
Father, I said, that's impossible for me. I am what I am. I know nothing but Stromford.
Even so, you must go. There are cities enough. Canterbury, Great Wexley, Winchester, even London.
What are these places like?
They have many souls living there, far more than here, too many to count. But I assure you, they are Christians.
Father, I said, I don't even know where these cities are.
I'm not so certain myself, he admitted. Follow the roads. Ask for help as you go. God will guide you.
Is there no other way?
You could find an abbey and offer yourself to the church, but it's a grave step, and you're hardly prepared. In any case, you don't have the fees. If I had them, they would be yours. No, the most important thing is for you to get away.
There's something about my mother that you're keeping from me, is there not? I said.
He made no reply.
Father, I pressed, was God angry at her and me?
He shook his head.
It's not for men to know what God does or does not will. What I do know is that you must leave.
Frustrated, I rose up, only to have the priest hold me back.
Your way will be long and difficult, he said. If you can remain hidden in the forest for another day, I'll find some food to sustain you for a while, and perhaps someone will know the best way to go.
As you say.
Your obedience speaks well for you. Come back tomorrow night, prepared to leave. Meet me at Goodwife Peregrine's house. I'll ask her to give you some things to protect you on your way.
I started off again.
And, he added, as if coming to a decision, when you come, I'll tell you about your father.
I turned back.
Why can't you tell me now?
Better, safer, to learn such things just before you go. That and my blessing is all I can give.
Was he a sinner? I demanded. "Did he commit some crime? Should I be ashamed of him?"
"I'll tell you all I know when you come to Peregrine's. Make sure it's dark, so you'll not be seen."
I took his hand, kissed it, then started off, only to have him draw me back again.
"Can you read?"
"No more than my mother."
"But she could."
"Father, you're greatly mistaken."
"She could write, too."
I shook my head in puzzlement. "These things you say, a name, reading, writing, my father, why would my mother keep such things from me?" The priest became very still. Then, from his pocket, he removed my mother's cross of lead, the one with which she so oft prayed, which was in her hands when she died. I'd forgotten about it. He held it up.
"Your mother's?"
"I know," I said sullenly.
"Do you know what's on it?"
"Some writing, I think."
"I saw your mother write those words."
I looked at him in disbelief.
"But tomorrow,"
he said, cutting me off and folding my fingers over the cross,
"I'll explain. Just remember, God mends all. Now go," he said, "and stay well hidden."
Filled with dissatisfaction, I stepped from the church. As I did, I thought I saw a shadow move. Concerned that I'd been observed, I stood still and scrutinized the place where I'd seen movement, but nothing shifted or gave sound. Deciding it had been just my fancy, and in any case too upset to investigate, I made my way back to the forest, where I slept but poorly. Why had I been so falsely accused? I kept asking myself. How could I be proclaimed a wolf's head? Regarding my father, why had my mother told me nothing about him? And what possible matter of importance could